The days are just about here. We've been waiting a long time for them to be here. I want to speak on the subject about the days of unleavened bread today, because between today and the last day of unleavened bread, I actually do have the opportunity to speak to all three of our congregations, but just one at a time. Someone said, you're not going to be able to be with us on the holy day. No, I'm not. I'm here today. And then I'm in Greensboro on the first day of Unleavened Bread, 1:30 in the afternoon, and then over with Hickory and Asheville in the Hickory congregation on the last day of Unleavened Bread. So I thought about what I might say to you today that might be the most important concept that I could get across. What could I present to you, the members of the congregation, in all three of our congregations, really, as the message or the most important concept for the days of Unleavened Bread? These days are so filled with meaning. But what is the most important lesson? What would I want to get across? What would I want us to come away with as we leave the days of unleavened bread? We haven't spent a whole lot of time talking about it this season, but I believe the lesson is bound up for us in the story of the Israelites' exodus from Egypt. We're going to touch on that a little bit today. We're not going to go back and read through the entire account. I assume you know that. But as we do go through the sermon today, I want us to keep in mind the parallels. There are incredible parallels for us of the Israelites coming out of Egypt and our journey out of sin. Both headed for the promised land, just different ones. They were headed, of course, for Canaan, you know, the land of Israel, if you want to call it. And we're headed for the kingdom of God. They were engaged on a journey out of slavery, out of Egypt. We're engaged in a journey out of sin. I hope we all realize that without deliverance from God, and we were delivered from God, we would have no opportunity to be released from slavery to sin. We would still be out there with the rest of the world. God called us out of sin. Nothing that we did on our own. We responded to it, and here we are. The Passover and the days of unleavened bread, again, picture our deliverance and our journey out of that world, the world of us being a slave to sin. We could no more come out of that than the Israelites could have left Egypt prior to being miraculously delivered, of course, by God through Moses. There's something that's part of the model prayer that Jesus taught us to pray. That model prayer is included, or is provided there for us in Matthew 6:13, and it simply says there, "Do not lead us into temptation, but deliver us from the evil one." What does that mean to us? If you're looking for a title today, that was going to be it. Deliver us from evil. How real is that to us? To pray that God would deliver us from the evil one. Who is that? Do we know who the evil one is? For the ancient Israelites, their evil one, well, who was it? It was, well, the guy that was beating them at the time, under the direction of Pharaoh, their evil one. They were slaves to him, again, with no possible escape from his brutality or the brutality of the taskmasters. What was that like to live that way day after day after day? Totally hopeless. Knowing that even if you had children, your children would be destined to that existence as well. It was only God, again, through Moses, who miraculously delivered them from bondage, brought them out to a new life, delivered them from their evil one. Who is our evil one? Well, we know our evil one is Satan the devil. Let's briefly review. This is concepts that we've heard before right here, but let's review this. Lucifer, the prime example of deciding. He was the great archangel, but he decided. How this came about, we don't know, but what the result is recorded for us. The prime example of deciding, no, I want to do things different from God. My way is better than yours, God. And so it's recorded for us in Isaiah 14 and verse 12. And the lament is there, how are you fallen? It's like, I can't believe this happened. How are you fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning? You were so incredible. I can't imagine that this happened. How are you cut down to the ground, you who weaken the nations? For you said in your heart, this is an internal thought process. It's something that is given some consideration and thought about. And this is what was said. I will ascend into heaven and I will exalt my throne. He had a throne. I will exalt my throne above all the other angels, above everything that God has created. And I will sit on the mountain of the congregation on the far sides of the north. And I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. And I will be like, or even I will be, the Most High. We believe this describes the origin of the evil one and what he did that caused him to be known as the evil one. This attitude of, I know better than God. My way. And that was the origin of this, of what became the evil one. I know better than God. I don't have to submit to God. Rather, I will set myself up in place of God, and I will decide. God has no right telling me what to do, because after all, I'm pretty smart. That is an attitude of total defiance and rebellion against this great God, the great God that Lucifer knew created him in the first place. He seems to have forgotten that. And we look back at this story, and we cannot imagine how that could have happened. We say, how stupid Lucifer was. And the angels have followed him. Why couldn't they see through that? Why did they follow him in the rebellion? How could Lucifer, as powerful and brilliant as he was, knowing the awesome power and the glory of God, he knew that. He was able, as a spirit, as an angel, he was able to comprehend the things that we cannot comprehend. The glory and the majesty of God. And yet he thought his was so awesome and glorifying or whatever that he could even become God himself. How could is it that he believed he knew better than God? And we marvel at that. But Satan used that same reasoning on our ancestors, on Adam and Eve. He appealed to that logic of, well, I can decide. I know better. Who is God to tell me what to do? Yes, he created me, but that doesn't make any difference. I'm still pretty smart. He created me smart. And we know the story in Genesis 3. The serpent comes to Eve, you know, and has God said, you shall not eat of every tree of the garden? And then said, well, we can eat the tree of the fruit of the garden, but there's one we can't, the tree of which is in the midst of the garden. God said, you shall not eat of it lest you touch it. You shall not touch it lest you die. And the one who was Lucifer, in the form of the serpent now, as Satan, you will not surely die. You know better than that. God knows that in the day you eat of that, your eyes will be opened, and you will be even smarter than you are now. You'll be like God. You'll know good and evil. And the woman thought, well, that makes sense. And she observed for herself that the food was pleasant to the eyes, a tree desirable to make one wise. So she took of the fruit and ate and gave to Adam. And he said, I believe I'll eat too. And so the first recorded interaction of Satan the devil with mankind, he's influencing Adam and Eve to have that same attitude. Same one that Lucifer had. You should want to be like God. You need to be as smart as God. You need to make your own decisions. You don't have to listen to anybody telling you what to do. Why should you submit to God? Why should you let him tell you what's right and what's wrong? And Eve says, well, I think you got a point there. That sounds logical to me. Maybe God is holding back something from me that I need. Clearly, I can observe the fruit. Clearly, it's appealing to me. It smells great. It looks wonderful. I can imagine it must taste incredible. And I'm going to decide that for myself. And after all, there's nothing wrong with me being smarter. I need wisdom. I need to be like God. And if I can become more like God by having some of his wisdom, by eating of this fruit, well, I believe that's what I'll do. Don't you agree, Adam? We should be free to make our own choices about what we do here in the garden, because after all, this is our home. We live here. This is our tree, our fruit, and if we want to eat it, we can. Adam says, "That sounds pretty good to me. Let's eat." Well, we know the story. They were cast out of the garden and began to pay a heavy price for deciding for themselves to choose for themselves what is right and what is wrong. And time passed. And their descendants grew evil, more and more evil with every passing generation, until we get to the time, not long afterwards in recorded history, the time of Noah in chapter 6. The world has not become a happy place. Verse 5, Genesis 6. The Eternal saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth. The wickedness of man was great in the earth. And we wonder how wicked. What would it have been like living at that time? How much does it parallel the times that we're living in today? As it was in the days of Noah, so it shall be in the days of the coming of the Son of Man. Wickedness of man was great in the earth, and every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And the Lord was sorry he'd made man on the earth, grieved in his heart. And he said, "I'll destroy man whom I've created from the face of the earth, man and beast, creeping thing, birds of the air. I'm sorry I made them." What was it that was so upsetting to God? I believe our key is in the phrase, "The intent and the thoughts of the heart were only evil continually." What did that remind God of? It's back to an attitude thing, isn't it? The intent of the heart. I will do this my way. Nobody tells me how to live. I decide for myself. And verse 11, "The earth was corrupt before God and filled with violence. And so God looked upon the earth. Indeed, it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way on the earth." You see, they weren't yielding. They weren't submitting to God's way. It was all, "It's my way. My way. I decide." So as descendants of Adam and Eve, they were doing exactly as their parents, you might say, had taught them by their example. You choose for yourself what's right and wrong. And yet, in all this wickedness, God selected a very few individuals to see a different way of life, a way that does, in fact, submit to the will of God, yields to the will of God, not to the self. And so, God decides to start over with Noah, with one righteous family. And Noah's attitude, Noah's approach to God. Verse 22, "Thus Noah did, according to all that God commanded him, so Noah did." No questions asked. And God says, "Here's an attitude I can work with. It's rare on the earth today." How rare was it? Apparently, one. Maybe the family. But God says, "Here's a guy who will listen to me and does what I say. And look what I'm going to ask him to do." And still he says, "Okay, I'll do it." Build an ark? Where? How long? You know, we need to put ourselves in Noah's place and consider what that was like for him. To look at the world around you, Noah could have concluded, "God's dead. God's hiding. God's not in the picture anywhere. Look at what he's allowed the earth to become. It's so evil here. God has died. God's gone away. God's nowhere in sight, it seems like. How evil this earth is. Everyone around you is corrupt to one degree or another. Nobody has anything to do with God. You can't go anywhere and find another, quote, church person, converted person. Nobody to talk to. You seem to be the only one following God. Now, this God that you seem to be the only one who believes in, nobody else does. But you have like a vision or you're hearing something that you discern to be the voice of God. And God says, build a boat, Noah. A big boat. It's going to take a long time. But you and your sons, your family, you begin building this boat. It's not even close to the sea. It's going to take you about 100 years. How old was he in the first place? It's already, 500 years old at this time? And by the way, Noah, as you build this boat, you start telling the people what's going to happen. You tell them there's going to be a flood, a worldwide flood. It's going to cover the highest mountains on the earth. Everyone will die. Your only hope is to be aboard the boat, the ark that I'm building. I will even bring the animals onto the ark. You have become the laughingstock of the community. You're the biggest joke around. People come from all over to see this boat that you're building. And they ridicule you and your family. What was that like for Mr. and Mrs. Noah, Ham, Shem, and Japheth, and their wives? Did God ask Noah to do something that was very difficult and somewhat unusual that he could have never expected? And what did we read? After all that instruction, Noah did according to all that God commanded him. So he did. We can learn a lesson from that. Noah has a good outcome. The rest of the world does not. They will have a good outcome when they wake up. And they'll be gasping for air. They drowned. But because of his obedience and faith in God, he and his family were spared. But his descendants did not stay with the program. It wasn't long till the earth became corrupt again. And we know of Nimrod and so on. What about us? Do we have an attitude like Noah? When God lays down certain rules and expectations that he has for us, is our attitude an attitude that says, whatever God commands me to do, I will do? It sounds odd to me. But that's okay. God's telling me to do it. I will do it anyway. Or do we rather look for an excuse? That doesn't make sense, God. I would be laughed at. I'd be ridiculed. I can't do that. What would people think about me? One could say that Noah was delivered from the evil world that was all around him. He was delivered from the wrath of Satan, who no doubt thought he had won a major victory against mankind. Look, everybody's dead. I can handle Noah still. I'll get to him after the floodwaters recede. You watch, I'll get to him yet. I'm going to win this. Now, why was Noah delivered? Why him? Why was he delivered? I think it is because of this attitude of doing whatever God commanded him to do without challenging God, without questioning God. Even when all appearances, it seems like this is not necessary. I don't need to build a boat because it's impossible for a flood. And you're asking me to do something that doesn't make any sense. He built it anyway. He built it anyway. What about us? Should we have the expectation that God will deliver us from evil? Do we have the attitude of Noah? Do we have an attitude of total submission to God? I will do whatever you ask me to do. I am committed to you. We did that at baptism. We committed to God. Whatever you ask me to do, I will do. I will not challenge you. I will not ask questions. I simply will submit. Total submission to the authority of God. Let's review Exodus 13. We have the story of ancient Israel being in slavery in Egypt. Coming out of that world, it's such a perfect analogy for us. But what attitude is still there? An attitude that we had seen in the Garden of Eden, an attitude that we have seen at the time of the flood, the time of Noah. What attitude still is existing in the nation of Israel? Exodus 13, verse 17. It came to pass when Pharaoh had let the people go, God did not lead them by way of the land of the Philistines, but that was near. So that would have been the expected path. I'm going on a journey. I'm coming out of sin. Here's the path I think we'll take. This is the most direct path. It will take us to the promised land. Here we go. We're going to be there in a few days. For God said, lest perhaps the people change their minds when they see war and they return to Egypt. Things are going to be bad out in this wilderness. And if you go the way you think you're going to go, Egypt's just across the mountain over there. And you'll go back. You'll want to go back. But I'm going to lead you a different way. It was going to be the way of the Red Sea. There was to be no turning back. Verse 18. So God led the people around by way of the wilderness of the Red Sea. And the children of Israel went up in an orderly rank out of the land of Egypt. Moses took the bones of Joseph with him, for he had placed the children of Israel under solemn oath, God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones from here. So they took their journey from Succoth, camped in Etham at the edge of the wilderness. And the Eternal went before them, day by day. He is there. He's clearly evident as they begin their journey. In the pillar of cloud to lead the way. And by night in the pillar of fire. He gave them light so as to go by day or by night. And he did not take away the pillar of cloud by day or the pillar of fire by night from before the people. We have a couple of things to notice in this story, in this account. Again, I think it's particularly important to note that they did not go the most direct route. They were led by God unexpectedly toward an obstacle, toward the biggest obstacle besides maybe a mountain. They're encamped by the Red Sea. We also notice that from the very beginning of their journey, God demonstrates in a miraculous way through the pillar of fire and the cloud that He's going to be with them. He's right there with them day by day. God's walking this walk with you, Israel. He's right here. Look, you can see Him. Wouldn't you think it would really increase our faith today if we could see the power of God demonstrated to us, if we went out from our homes at night and over our home was a big blazing pillar of fire and we said, that's God. God's watching over me tonight. Or as we drove here to church today, this, you know, in the car in front of us was a big pillar, a cloud-shaped car. I don't know why. And we're following that. Oh, that's obvious. That's God. We're following God. I think that would be quite impressive. Well, it didn't go so good for the Israelites. And even though God was with them, they seemed to forget. Exodus 14. They're already on a detour leading them towards the Red Sea when suddenly from out of nowhere, again, as they're approaching the Red Sea now, the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, verse 8, king of Egypt. And he pursued the children of Israel. And the children of Israel went out with boldness, but the Egyptians pursued them. The Egyptians pursued them. Who is Pharaoh and the Egyptians? This is Satan the devil, and this is sin. This is the way of sin. Sin will pursue you after you have left it. Did you ever notice that? It continues to harass you, to go after you. all the horses and chariots of Pharaoh, his horsemen and his army, and he overtook them camping beside this place. And Pharaoh drew near. Who's Pharaoh a type of? Satan the devil draws near as you're making your escape out of sin. The children of Israel lifted up their eyes, and behold, it was the Egyptians marching after them. And so they were very afraid. I've left sin. I've left Egypt. How can it be, Moses, how can it be the Pharaoh's chasing us when you delivered us from Egypt? And yet Egypt is now following us and they're going to take us back. Do you see the parallels? After baptism, and we go on our journey. The children of Israel cried out to the Lord. They said to Moses, "Because there were no graves in Egypt, have you taken us away to die in this wilderness? Why have you so dealt with us to bring us out of Egypt? Didn't we tell you, let us alone that we may serve the Egyptians?" No, they didn't say that. They said, "Isn't it great? We're finally being delivered out of Egypt. We're being saved. It would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than die out here in this wilderness." They forgot their baptism counseling, as it were. People want to go back right away when things get tough. This was not the reaction they should have given after what God has so miraculously done for them. And we look at this and we are amazed and we say, why? Why didn't they realize God was with them? Why didn't they realize God can do anything to protect me? He opened the Red Sea. The plagues, the firstborn. How strange we think it is that they wanted to run back to the slavery, to the bondage of Egypt, than just trust God, who had already done such amazing miracles for them. He protected them from these things, from the plagues, the firstborn. I wonder what God's attitude was towards the Israelites, seeing their lack of trust. After all I've done for you, you still don't trust me? He could have been quite upset. He could have just let the Egyptians capture them. "Go ahead, Pharaoh. They don't trust me anyway. I'll let them die. I'll start off with another group." Thankfully, that's not what happened. Chapter 14, verse 13. Moses said to the people, "Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid." Remember our parallels. Don't be afraid. Stand still. See the salvation of the Lord, which He will accomplish for you today, even in the face of danger. For the Egyptians that you see today, you will see again no more. The Lord will fight for you. You shall hold your peace. And the miracle happens. Moses stretches out his hand over the sea. And the Lord caused the sea to go back by a strong east wind all that night. Made the sea into dry land. The waters were divided. And so the children of Israel went into the midst of the sea on dry ground. The waters were a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. And the Egyptians saw that and said, "Oh, we can do this too." They pursued, went right after them in the midst of the sea. All Pharaoh's horses, his chariots, his horsemen, they didn't have a good outcome. They all died. But the Eternal saved Israel that day out of the hands of the Egyptians. And the Israelites saw the Egyptians dead on the shore. Thus Israel saw the great work that the Lord had done in Egypt. They saw it. They believed it now. And the people feared the Lord. And they believed the Lord. And they believed His servant Moses. Okay, now we're going to have a good outcome. Now things are fine. Now I see it. Oh, I should have known better. I shouldn't have complained. You're able to deliver me after all. You did deliver me from evil. The Israelites finally ready to believe in the power and the might of the great God who was able to protect them. Who was able to actually do what He said. He would lead them to the promised land. And they saw His great power, and they were impressed. They knew now, no matter what, God's able to guide me. God's able to protect me. I will make it to the promised land. I have nothing to worry about. I will reach that destination. I'm convinced of it. Incredibly, that attitude of faith and trust in the deliverance of God was only going to last a few days. Chapter 16, verse 1. And they journeyed from Elim. And all the congregation of the children of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after they departed from the land of Egypt. Verse 2. Then the whole congregation of the children of Israel complained against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. And the children of Israel said, "Oh, that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt. I remember it was so wonderful as we were in Egypt. We sat by the pots of meat. We ate bread to the full. But Moses, you brought us out here into this wilderness. You're going to kill this whole assembly with hunger. Moses, what have you done to us? Moses, we're out here suffering because of the way that you led us here. It's your fault." And Israel forgot about the pillar of fire that was still glowing brightly in the sky at night. They forgot about the parting of the Red Sea. They forgot about the destruction of Pharaoh's army. They forgot about the bitter water at Marah being made fresh and sweet, and they had delicious water to drink. And now, because of their physical hunger, they seem to have forgotten that God was their guide, their protector, their provider. It wasn't Moses. They thought it was. Their problem was that they had no faith in Moses. They did not believe Moses had any power to provide for them and keep them safe. And it seems God, although looks like I can see him, it looks like he's abandoned us again because I'm so hungry. I'm so thirsty. We're lost. And they clearly let their selfishness and their pride affect their judgment. They should have known better. But again, God was merciful and patient with them. When they're hungry, he provided the manna for them. And in so doing, he taught them how to observe the Sabbath day that they had likely forgotten. Sadly, the Israelites would repeat this process over and over and over again for years to come. God was trying to make it so clear and so evident to the people that he was there for them. "I'm here, my children. I'm right here. I'm your provider. I'll protect you. You can trust me. Believe me. Follow where I lead you. I've never let you down. I've always delivered you in the past. I will continue to do so in the future." And they couldn't seem to believe. God had said, "I will fight your battles for you." God had said, "I will bring you into the promised land. Just trust me. Just follow me." Why? Why did Israel have such short-sightedness? Why were they so, like I am now, nearsighted? Couldn't see except right in front of them. Why couldn't they remember to rely on God, to trust God? Is it because they lost sight of the goal? They were out in the wilderness. The wilderness journey was taking longer. Wait, what happened to the promised land? Their journey out of Egypt took them on a different route than they thought they were going to go. This journey's taking longer than they ever expected it to take. 2 years have passed, and we're not there yet. In another generation, 22 years have passed. And we're not there yet. Far more obstacles to overcome than they ever imagined. And they soon began to realize, this journey to the promised land, it's not what I thought. It's taking so much longer. And it's not easy out here. The journey is difficult. And their focus turned from the joy of life in a new land to the pain and the problems of right now. I'm hungry now. I hurt now. I'm thirsty. I'm afraid. I'm hungry. I'm tired. Where's God? We're told in 1 Corinthians 10, verse 12, that these things were written down for our example, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. What have we learned from Israel? What can we learn from them about our journey out of slavery towards a promised land, towards a kingdom of God? We are coming out of slavery. We are coming out of sin. Romans 6, the baptism chapter, we covered this last night at the baptism ceremony. And I want to cover it just briefly here with you. A couple of verses here. Romans 6. Verse 15. What then? Shall we sin because we're not under the law but under grace? You know, we are no longer under the penalty of the law. That's been paid for. The death penalty is paid by the grace of Jesus Christ and God the Father. So certainly not. Do you not know that to whom you present yourselves slaves to obey? And we have. We presented ourselves. At baptism, we did that. We presented ourselves. I'm a slave now of obedience and righteousness. You are that one slaves whom you obey. It's going to be one or the other. You're either going to serve sin to death or obedience leading to righteousness. There's only the two ways. So just as sure as the Israelites were in slavery in Egypt serving the Egyptians, before our calling out of this world from God, we were slaves. We were slaves to this world. We were slaves to what you see outside. We were slaves to a way of life that is contrary to God and to God's way of life. But something changed. Verse 17. God be thanked that although you were slaves of sin, yet something happened to you. And this is extremely important. What happened that changed things? After the calling, after God says, I will deliver you, I've called you to deliver you out of sin, you obeyed from the heart. That form of doctrine to which you were delivered. It was revealed to you, given to you, and you obeyed from the heart. That's what sets you free from being a slave to sin. Obedience from the heart, not just because I read it in a book. People read it in a book and don't believe from the heart. We must. I want to flip back to the Old Testament again and look at one more example from the Israelites to consider. And that's in Numbers, chapter 16. Sometime later, the story of Korah. Numbers 16, verse 1. Korah, the son of Izhar, the son of a few other people, took men and rose up before Moses with some of the children of Israel. 250 leaders of the congregation, representatives of the congregation who were men of renown, men who should have known, who should know God's way, who were being taught through Moses. They gathered together against Moses and Aaron. When did that conversation start? How did it start? What was the first thing said? What should have happened when the first comments were made against Moses and Aaron? But they said to Moses and Aaron, this is their conclusion, you take too much upon yourselves. For look at us, the whole congregation. The congregation is holy, every one of them. And the Lord is out there among the congregation too, Moses. Who do you think you are? Why do you exalt yourselves above the assembly of the Lord? Why is that story recorded for us? It seems illogical. After all, Korah and the men of renown had been through. Didn't make sense. What was so wrong, though, with what Korah and his followers did? Do we see the connection with an attitude that we've already talked about before? I'll decide. I'm as good as making decisions about things as you are. Why should I have to submit to you, Moses? You're not the only holy person here. We can decide for ourselves. Why is it you always have to be the one in charge, Moses? What makes you think you're better than us? Do we see a humble, submissive, yielded attitude here? Or are we seeing an attitude of the serpent? I'm holy enough to decide for myself what I'll do, what I can do. And I can run things just as well as you can, Moses, maybe even better. I've got 250 men of renown here that are going to stand by me. We'll work things out. We'll get to the promised land a whole lot faster than you ever could, Moses. So you move over. I'll take your place. Do you see how God would hate that attitude? What would it remind him of? Do you suppose it reminded him of one archangel named Lucifer? So God deals very severely with this attitude of pride, arrogance, presumptuousness. We have seen through the ages what problems this has caused for the world. And when we review the story, don't we think to ourselves as we look back at this story, once again, how dumb of Korah and these other men to do that? Why didn't they see? Why didn't they know better? They had seen the miracles God performed. Why wasn't it clear to them that God was working through Moses and Aaron? It didn't mean they weren't good people. But God clearly, who was the one that held the staff over the Red Sea? God was working through Moses. Who was the one who said, I will lead you out of Egypt? God has revealed the plan to me. God's working with me. Who told them about painting the blood on the doorpost? Anyone should have been able to see that. One would think so. Why are we looking at this today? Why do I think this is the most important concept that I can deliver to you during the days of unleavened bread as we approach them? We're told to put sin out of our lives. That's what we're committing to do. That's what we have committed to do. That's what we're going to do during these days of unleavened bread. We're going to once again put leavening out, picturing that I am absolutely thoroughly committed to putting sin out of my life. And yet, year by year, we make this commitment and we still see, wait, there's still sin in my life. Why didn't I put it out? What is the root cause of sin? We need to dwell on that. We need to think about that. In James chapter 1, maybe you know where I'm going here. The root cause of sin. We've seen it in the examples today. Verse 13. Let no one say when he is tempted, I am tempted by God. God isn't tempted by evil and doesn't tempt anyone. But each one is tempted when he is, and I've got this in red letters, drawn away by his own desires. When he's drawn away by what he wants to do, by what he thinks is right, and he is enticed. That sounds good to me. That fruit looks and smells good. I believe I'd like to taste it. It's enticing. This world, it's enticing. I want to experience the world for myself. When desire is conceived, it gives birth to sin. And sin brings forth death. God hates this. Sin originates with your own personal desires. Your human nature that's saying, my way is best. I decide for myself. Nobody tells me what to do. And God hates that attitude. That's the attitude we've been seeing throughout our examples. What is the opposite of your own desires. Wouldn't it be the desires then of somebody else? Again, what is God's clear command regarding selfishness, if you will, or pride, whatever way you want to say it, or this arrogance? What's the opposite of that? What would God have us do instead? Again, we've been through it, Philippians 2. This, brethren, this is core to Christianity. This is core to putting sin out of your life, to keeping it out. We have to experience this attitude change. We cannot have the pride. We've got to have the yieldedness, the submission to following God no matter what. Philippians 2:3, let nothing be done through ambition or conceit, but in lowliness of mind, let each esteem others better than himself. Yes, we look out for our own interest, but also for the interest of others. Let this mind be in you. It was also in Christ Jesus. That verse right there, that is absolutely essential. That is key to putting sin out of your life. It's an attitude of thinking of others before yourself. This attitude of thinking, my way is best, putting the self first, this arrogance, this self-righteousness, if you will, that is at the root of, I can't think of a sin that it's not the root of. Perhaps you can. Think of a violation of God's law that doesn't originate with pride and selfishness. My way, what I want, what I think is best. And God has given us example after example of saying, I hate that. And then He specifically tells us in several passages, I hate this. I'll read them. You can jot them down and I'll read through them. I've got 4 or 5. Proverbs 8:13. The fear of the Lord is hatred of evil. Pride and arrogance and the evil way and the perverted speech I hate. Proverbs 6, verse 16. These 6 things the Lord hates. 7 are an abomination. Look, a proud look. A proud look. You know what that's like, don't you? You've seen it. God says, I hate that. 1 Samuel 2:3. Talk no more so proudly. Let not arrogance come from your mouth. For the Lord is a God of knowledge, and by Him actions are weighed. How about Jeremiah 50, verse 32? The most proud shall stumble and fall. None shall raise him up. I will kindle a fire in his cities, and it shall devour all around about him. One more. Isaiah 13:11. I will punish the world for its evil, and the wicked for their iniquity. I will put an end to the pomp of the arrogant and lay low the pompous pride of the ruthless. We see that in our society today. Don't have to worry about it. God's going to deal with that. That's a promise right there. Why does God hate pride and arrogance and vanity and selfishness? Why does He hate it so much? It's because He knows what it does. He knows the end result. He's seen it from the time of Lucifer's rebellion. He's seen it through the examples we talked about today. God knows the destruction and evil, this pompous arrogance and self-centeredness. He knows the evil that has caused on this earth. Look at the suffering around us in this world today. Look at man's inhumanity to man. My way. I know what's best. He has seen the suffering. He has heard the cries of the children who've experienced this inhumanity. All in the refusal to simply submit and yield to the government and the authority of God. They will not listen to God. God is dead. God is gone. God has no say over my life because I decide for myself. Again, pride, arrogance, the root cause of so many problems. Think of even today, think of your own home, your own lives, marriages. Some have marriage problems. What is the root cause? Is it a certain selfishness that's there? Thinking more about my needs than yours? How much happier a marriage would be if the desires of the self were replaced with the loving concern of the needs and the happiness of the spouse? It's not easy to do. But that's what leads to happy marriages. Submission of your will to someone else, to God's way. What about relationships with others? Problems we have in dealing with conflict, hurt feelings. We talked a lot about that, being offended. What if we could replace the attitude, again, there is no selfishness and no pride, but instead, always an attitude of submission, of forgiveness, of reconciliation, of love. What if that's what there was? That's all there was. What does it matter who started it? What does it matter what was said? Is your attitude the same attitude that Jesus Christ would have? That's our standard. That's what we were asked to do in Philippians 2. Again, try to think of any problem, any difficulty in your life you may be experiencing right now. You're going through something that's difficult. If your attitude towards this issue was a complete removal, there is no thought of wanting your will to be done, your desires to be accomplished, that's gone. Nothing there. Nope. Instead, it's replaced a total attitude of willing submission to God. Your will be done. I have signed on no matter what. No matter what trial I go through, no matter what is happening to me, I will follow you. I have counted the cost. I love you. I submit to you. I will follow your will. Please show me, guide me, direct me in your paths. What if everyone had that attitude? How would the world change? What if nobody in your immediate family was selfish, proud, or arrogant? Think of your family. Yeah. Families have conflicts. How do we resolve family conflicts? What if we apply that to everybody here? Everybody here. Now, that should be the case already. It should exist. Do we look out for the needs of others in the church, esteeming their needs more important than ours, or at least as equal? Imagine what things would be like if all your friends and all your neighbors would be like this. They're concerned about your needs. My neighbor would not let his dog bark continually. He would realize that's bothering Mr. Kelly. Someday it'll be like that. Imagine your coworkers on the job. Everybody's concerned about you. Everyone else is concerned. Not so much. There's no office pride and arrogance. Trying to get ahead, stab the boss in the back. Even at school, the same thing. Imagine a world where everyone's patient and caring, humbly serving others in meekness and loving concern, watching out for the welfare of others that they come in contact with. I know, Mr. Kelly's up, he's dreaming. Yeah, right. It sounds impossible. Well, it's not. Romans 14. A day is coming, and we celebrate that time. Romans 14, verse 16. Therefore, do not let your good be spoken of as evil. We would try this. People are saying, who do you think you are acting that way? What are you trying to get? But don't let your good be spoken of as evil. The kingdom of God is not eating and drinking. But what is it? And then it goes on to tell us what the kingdom, in other words, it's not physically related. What is God's kingdom? righteousness and peace and joy in or through the Holy Spirit. You see, we're describing what the millennium will be like, what God's kingdom will be like. We're preparing for that. You ever know the Passover and the days of unleavened bread, what they lead to? They lead to the Feast of Trumpets, the Feast of Tabernacles, and the Last Great Day. We're describing today, through the actions that we should have, this love, this outgoing concern, this submission, this willingness to serve. We're describing what the millennium will be like, because we're going to help bring that about. There will be righteousness and peace and joy. So we have the responsibility as families, as individuals, as a congregation, as a church. We have a responsibility to be that like that now. We're ambassadors of that. We're representatives of that way of peace and righteousness and joy. If we're to be accepted to God and expecting to be those rulers in the millennium who bring that about, shouldn't we be showing God, you know, I'm with that. I understand that. I am willing to put down pride and arrogance, the haughtiness and that froward, haughty spirit. I'm willing to put that out. I'm willing to submit, to yield, to serve, to care. And learn that now. Because God says, that's the way it's going to be. You're going to be my co-rulers, co-heirs. You followed me. You like me. You walk in my steps. You sit with me on my throne. You've got to teach. You've got to be like what this is going to be. God has to see that in our lives right now, today, this week, and after the days of unleavened bread are over. A righteous and a peaceful attitude is not one of strife, contention, pride, or arrogance. James 3, again, it has the contrast here. Again, I think you're familiar, verse 13. We're talking about being wise and understanding here. So it's asking the question, who's wise and understanding among you? Well, let him show by his conduct. And that's what we're asking today. That through our conduct, as we display it here during the days of unleavened bread, our conduct, that his works are done in meekness. In meekness of wisdom. And then he contrasts what he will not tolerate. But if you have bitter envy and self-seeking, there's the danger. Pride, the root cause. Bitter envy and self-seeking in your heart. In your heart. Don't boast. Don't lie against the truth. Don't make excuses. Don't say it's okay, because it is not. That wisdom does not descend from above. But it is earthly, sensual, and it is of the adversary. It is of Lucifer. It is of the serpent, Satan the devil. It is demonic. For where envy and self-seeking exist, that resulted in the flood, the destruction, the earth opening up under Korah. For where envy and self-seeking exist, confusion and every evil thing are there. But the wisdom that's from above is like the kingdom of God, is like the millennial rule of Jesus Christ. Pure, peace, gentleness, willingness to yield, mercy, good fruits, no partiality, no hypocrisy. Now the fruit of righteousness, that end result that we just described that we're looking for, is sown in peace by you. Those who make peace. Because that's what we're doing today and what we're doing during the days of unleavened bread. We are learning peace and how to get there. With an attitude like that, it is impossible to experience any other result other than succeeding in putting sin out of your life. That's guaranteed. If you expect to overcome sin, That's the transgression of God's commandments. And that is the lesson of the days of unleavened bread, overcoming sin. You must have an attitude change from one of pride, envy, and self-seeking, rather to an attitude of peace and gentleness and willingness to yield. That is the key to putting sin out of your life. And we ask God, deliver us from the evil one. And He will. The evil one is Satan. Satan always works by using an appeal to the self. I know best, not God. So I would submit to you that the most important thing that we can take away from observing these days is knowing that your personal attitude, and you, when we examined ourselves, I hope we've looked at this, that your personal attitude is one of sincerity, humility, totally yielding, totally submitting to the authority of God, the authority that He has over you and over your life. You ask God, as it says in the model prayer, your will be done in my life, no matter what. We recognize the satanic attitude. We recognize we have to fight against this adversary if we are ever expected to make a successful journey out of Egypt, out of sin. We're about to take the bread at Passover. We're going to show that we are striving to be Christ-like. We're going to commit to that together. In 1 Peter 5 and verse 5, it says, 1 Peter 5 and verse 5, likewise, you younger, submit yourselves to the elders. And then he says, yes, all of you. And this is our instruction. This is our final thoughts as we head into these days. Be submissive to one another and be clothed with humility. We put it on daily. Because God will resist the proud, but He gives grace. Think of what that is, God's grace. He gives grace to the humble. You humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, He will exalt you in due time. So God's instructions are clear. The reason He tells us to clothe ourselves with humility and fight against a proud, arrogant attitude, that ought to be clear to us too. Because from the very beginning of, if you even want to call it time, when Lucifer made that decision and brought along the angels that became demons, that attitude of pride has caused untold suffering and untold heartache for this world, for mankind. Many examples are recorded in the Bible for us, as we've seen. But it stems from Satan himself. We read that there in James. We read that God will resist anyone with that attitude. Again, it's so important. We don't want God to resist us. We need His grace. We need His Spirit. We need to become like Him. And God knows that the key to peace and happiness and contentment and fulfillment and joy, having a spirit of cooperation, humility, graciousness, pure, unfeigned love, the key is getting rid of that pride. One last scripture, 2 Corinthians 6, verse 4. 2 Corinthians 6, verse 4. But in all things we commend ourselves. And this is our commitment to God as we begin these days. But in all things we commend ourselves, and we'll skip on down, to purity, knowledge, long-suffering, kindness, by the Holy Spirit, by sincere love, by the word of truth, by the power of God, by the armor of righteousness. Again, these are the characteristics we'll see in the people in the millennium. We must have today characteristics of fruit of God's Holy Spirit, things we must have in our lives today as we resist Satan's influence in our lives. So, brethren, these are the things I wanted to bring to you today that we should think about as we enter and as we go through and after the days of unleavened bread, looking for ways to put sin out of our lives. filling our hearts and minds with a Christ-like attitude of sincere humility and willingness to yield, understanding, love, total surrender to God and to His will as we continually ask God, deliver us from evil. I hope that you all have a most meaningful Passover here. Very celebrate the night to be much observed. Observe it much. Have a wonderful time, wonderful evening together, and then really celebrate the days of unleavened bread. And we'll see you back here and then in a couple weeks.